Right, so I think I'm going to get started. My name is Chandra Krentz, and I'm from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And yeah, I'm really happy to be here to talk to you for the next couple days. And I'm going to talk to you primarily about the implementations of modern programming languages. So I thought first, just to kind of break the ice, I'd tell you a little bit about me. I'm happy to talk about any of this afterwards, beforehand, if it's something you want to chat about. My name is Chandra, pronounced Chandra. You can call me any variation of that. I really respond to most things, except for hey you. People get it wrong all the time, so when you'll hear that in the community all the time, it'll be Chandra or Chandra. But it's really Chandra, and I'm happy for you to call me that. You don't have to call me professor or doctor or whatever. I like Chandra, and I like to sort of have a more familiar interaction. I was born and raised in Indiana in the United States. It's a very rural community. Kind of grew up there, not having much exposure to computers until my father, who was a principal, brought home a Commodore 64. Kind of dates me, I know, but that's okay. I'm confident with that. I was age eight, and I've been interested in computers ever since. So I moved to Los Angeles. Big city in 1990, and I finished my undergraduate out there, and I didn't really know if I wanted to. I was working in the computer industry. Great time to work in the computer industry there. You didn't need an undergraduate degree. You barely needed to know anything about computers, and they were desperate to have people, so it was really easy to find jobs then. But then it started to change, and you really needed a higher degree to move up through the ranks. So I decided to do a master's at UC San Diego. Wasn't quite sure about the PhD and whether I wanted to be a professor or go into research. I didn't know either one of those things. I just thought industry was my thing. But when I got there and I started to do a little research, I felt that, I really like this. I'm really compelled by this. I like the autonomy. I like the challenges that sort of research brings. And I want to be a professor. So I didn't know any of this ahead of time. I sort of got into the swing of it and discovered that on the way. I had no idea what I wanted to work on. I started off in AI primarily because they had free pizza for lunch, and it sounded great for me. And I kind of evolved from there. I went into crypto, and it just wasn't my thing, but I loved the professor who was working on it. And it took me a while to realize that perhaps, I should do something more systems-y instead of more mathematical and theoretical, because I kept wanting to code everything that we were talking about. Got into mobile agents, and that sort of transitioned me into compilers and runtimes for Java virtual machines that are for mobile computing. By 2001, I finished everything at UC San Diego. I got a job at UCSB, where I've been ever since. I've been focused on primarily sort of feedback-directed optimization, so using feedback, watching the program and how it's behaving, and using that to guide optimizations. So not traditional compiler optimizations, runtime stuff. How does the runtime interact with the lower level systems? That's really what I've been focused on. Oops. It's been a Java-oriented. And then since I got tenure, which is 2007, I have sort of expanded my breadth of interests. Because you can take more risks at that point. Because you have tenure, you can investigate really interesting things. So I've really moved to full system adaptation. How does the programming language runtime, and it's still programming language focused, but how does the programming language and the programming language runtime interact with the lower level operating system, virtualization layers now, and actually multi-core hardware. So I've taken that a step further, most recently in the last year, to work in a distributed environment, primarily focused on cloud computing. So, but it's all, again, from the program, from the programmers, from the runtime perspective. And I've also been able to increase my breadth and activities in sort of outreach stuff. Again, so sort of on a daily basis, this is what my job looks like. This is pretty much typical of any professor at a Research One institution in the United States. I have lots of students. This varies across professors. Some people only like a couple. I like a big group. I like lots of collaboration. They are at all levels. I have about 4 or 5 PhD students at any one time. And then everybody else is bachelor's and master's degree students. I teach one course per quarter, That's a light load because it is a research institution. We are in quarters. All of UC, University of California, is on quarters. Most schools are on semesters. So we have three quarters in a year. These are 10-week courses, which makes it really challenging because you can do a ton of stuff in 10 weeks. And two quarters is not the same as one semester. So it's really challenging. Berkeley is the only UC that is not on quarters. They moved to semesters a long time ago. We've talked about it. It is just millions and millions of dollars to do in terms of the infrastructure, the computing infrastructure, actually, from the financial perspective for the university. So we're not changing. So we're stuck with that. But it's one course per quarter. Goes really fast. So if you're teaching, it's great. But if you miss one class, like for travel or whatever, you're done because you've missed, you know, 1/20th of the class. So it's really tough. But I teach a wide range of stuff, programming languages, implementation, so basic sort of compilers, but for modern languages, dynamic compilation, hardware-software interface. I'm really interested in that virtualization layer, so I've been teaching that recently, object-oriented computing, mainly from the optimization perspective. I write grant proposals all the time because I have to keep my students funded, but it's not so bad. I'm happy to talk about that with you offline if you're concerned with that kind of thing. It just gets like a process like anything else. It's like you can write a paper, you can write a proposal, and you just have to stay at it, keep at it. I'm on lots of committees in the community and in my department. I'm really interested in getting more diverse people from diverse backgrounds into computer science, so I really focus on that. And so I'm in charge of revamping our lower division curriculum for our undergrads, and my job allows me to do that. You know, I have the freedom to go and pursue something that's a major change for our department. And I do a bunch of outreach and mentoring with Girls Incorporated, teaching little girls from financially disadvantaged backgrounds how to play video games, really. And the video games actually teach them how to do logic, how to think logically and do basic programming. So it's really exciting. It's a product from Microsoft called Kodu now, and it works for the Xbox. So I work with little girls to try to get them excited about computers. Okay, so that's sort of my life. I have a lot of stuff outside of this. This takes up a lot of time, but I still have a life. I have a family, and I am a cyclist, and I am outdoors a lot. So there is balance here, even though I'm just presenting the technical stuff. I love doing research. I love this area. And my main focus, my main draw, and it really has stayed consistently this way over the last years. It's really amazing. But there's so much to do, and that's what I'm hoping to give you a little inspiration about. If you're interested in this area or these things kind of excite you, even if you know nothing and you've never seen any of this before, that you can still do research in this area, and there's a ton of exciting problems from low-hanging fruit all the way up to really hard stuff. So, and the degree of impact varies there too, so it's there's a lot of opportunity. The three areas I sort of break down into compiler and runtime support in general, that's the dynamic compilation, the garbage collection, or the memory management. I've recently gotten more into interpretation, and I'll talk to you about why that's important. Profiling and feedback-directed optimization, but not just of the program itself. I want to change the operating system as it's running and the low-level virtualization as it's running, and you know the kernel modules as they're running, so that you can customize and adapt and specialize to the program's behavior. The other thing I've been looking at, it's sort of related, but it's sort of broadening this perspective, is the interaction between languages. So if you look at software today, it's written in lots of different languages, especially you know real complex software that industry uses. Lots of different languages, lots of different groups. It's no longer the case that you can just focus on the runtime and the program. You really have to understand how it's interacting with the operating system. Operating system does really influence the performance of the program. And this is not just for speed. This is for energy and power. This is extremely important. But also understanding how the program is going to use the underlying resources so that we know what the next generation hardware has to look like, right? The next generation software has to look like. Right? So I've looked at how do we better coordinate between the runtime and the operating system. So first of all, memory management. Virtual memory is what is the responsibility of the operating system. But garbage collection is different, but very similar in many ways. And that's the responsibility of the runtime. If you can better coordinate between those two, then you have a chance of just having performance across the entire system and for your program, right? And that's just one example. There's lots of examples. A runtime really is a miniature operating system. It's managing resources. It's multiplexing resources across different components. It's scheduling, right? And you're doing a lot of that also in the operating system. So you want to better coordinate those two to get the best efficiency in the overall platform. And then I'm really interested again, and because applications consist of components in different languages, you know, Ruby on Rails talks to the backend database. Database could be in C++ or Java. Everything's being done by message passing. But there's opportunities now with virtualization, because lots of things could be executing on your machine, entire systems. If you could better coordinate what's executing where, and when they're co-located, take advantage of the fact they're next to each other. Right, so I'll talk to you hopefully next class about how we could better coordinate between two runtimes of the same language, say Java Virtual Machine, and the first question you should have is, well, why would I have two Java Virtual Machines running? Well, if you look at people's systems today, everyone runs a Java app, runs in their own VM, even a single individual, right? And so if those apps interact. And that's nice because you get the isolation of the process, right? And then if you can go across this isolation boundary in a type-safe way, maybe there's some opportunities you could exploit with better communication. And then, of course, how do we communicate across languages? This is really exciting. This is what I've really been focused on recently. You know, I have, we have a large cloud computing infrastructure. It is Ruby and Ruby on Rails. It is Python. It is C++ and Java and some C. And all these things have to interact, and they have to interact efficiently. And how are we going to do that? Right now, it's this huge overhead in passing data back and forth, serializing and marshaling and communicating this. And a lot of times, things are on the same machine. Right? Or a lot of times when they're distributed, you know about the behavior, but nothing's being exploited. So I'll talk to you about sort of what the technologies are here and then what we potentially could do about it. And then last is sort of a culmination of all of this. If we move this into the distributed environment, like I've been referring to, you know, how can we think about the next generation of software, which is going to be distributed and parallel and concurrent? You know, how are we going to deal with all of that? How are we going to build our software systems? What do our programming languages have to look like? What kind of support do you need as programmers to build any of these components from the highest level all the way down to the virtualization level? And I'm doing it in the context of cloud computing. One, because it's interesting and cool, and it has a huge uptake in the commercial sector. So that gets me a lot of real applications, real systems, and it's really exciting. And I get a lot of students that way. And at the same time, it's directly applicable to the commercial sector. And that's really something I wanted to have recently, is impact in the real world as soon as possible. So thought what I'd do on my 3 days, my 3 hour and a half, or 3 hour and 20 minutes with you, is kind of just tell you about each of these components. The first is just basics. Some of you probably know this, know a couple of you, and some of you will know that this back and forth, but it'll get us all on the same page, so we can speak sort of the same language about what the techniques I'm going to use for the more advanced stuff here. And again, you shouldn't feel, if you know everything, that's great. You should maybe transfer to UCSB and come work for me. If you don't know any of it, that's fine too. I think, you know, I'm just here to give you some basics to start with and to give you a feel for the research opportunities that are available to you if you wanted to pursue something along these lines. So any questions? You can interrupt me at any time. I'm happy to go off track. In fact, I'd be excited to do so. I did prepare stuff, so it's really up to you. If you have questions about anything, let me know. So we good? Okay. So it's just to break the ice, get you talking a little. Because I do like some participation, although I can talk for very long times, periods at a time. I just want to talk about what are we talking about when you hear the words modern programming, high-level, popular languages? What's the first language you think of? Java, what else? JavaScript, good, what else? JavaScript. Who? C-sharp. C-sharp? Haskell, good, excellent, good answer. What else? Modern? Haskell's been around a long time. Yeah, good point. What else? Scala, good. What else? Oh, camel. Objective camel. Oh, camel. Python. What else? I've said one. Ruby. No one said Ruby. Right? Any others that you can think of? Any others that you think are interesting? BBBB.net. Okay. Not what I would call modern, but very interesting. Yes, indeed. So what are the characteristics of these languages? Why? Well, let's just start with the bottom one because I think that's the most interesting. Why are there so many? And notice there's so many and they all come from industry. What they've all sort of popped up by in sort of the open source community or by these individuals that aren't really from the academic community. Why are there so many? Great, yes. Why are there so many? Start with that. All right, I'll come back to you for the why do they die off. Why are there so many?
Someone thinks they can do it better than the existing language.
Yes, why do they think, what is better? So they obviously, somebody thinks that they can do better. When every time you get a new language, that person thinks they can do better. What are they doing better at? Someone else. What they need? Right, sort of. And that is that it's particular to that person, to that group, or that industry, or that sector, right? What does it mean, what they need? What would you need? What would you change a programming language to get you what you need? What do you need? What do you want in a programming language? I give you the perfect programming language. Be all, end all. What is it about a programming language that makes it good to you?
Well, going back a little bit.
Okay.
Certain things didn't exist, and so people simultaneously in different like island communities created these things.
Good. What didn't exist? Give me an example.
Page rendering languages.
Okay. You know, very good. Yep.
Described web pages.
Yes. So really, the web has evolved a ton, and sort of the functionality you need needs a language to support it. Is that sort of where you're going with that?
PHP developed at the same time as JSP. And
yes.
Other types of things. Like
yeah,
that.
Trying to do better. What else do you need? What do you programming language? Yeah. The design, yeah, sort of the compactly in a way you can express yourself about the design of the system very well, right? Expressibility. What else?
I think you have been given a domain, especially languages from industry tend to incorporate as primitives things that are often used.
Yes, and that's really what I was trying to push it towards. Domain is really important, and if you look, each of these languages started out with that particular domain. What you need is about the domain you work in, and so you're going to develop a language that's well suited to that, right? And then the language could broaden, right? I think a part of your question or postulation of, well, why don't they die out, or the languages should die out after a while, is that a lot of times these languages are broadening themselves to get a larger user base, to get to become more general, right? And they sort of lose that domain specificity, right? All right, So I think that's right. So we talked about, and so let's talk about some of the characteristics of these modern languages. We mentioned Java and C#. It's very interesting that you guys really started out with, and maybe it's just because some of you didn't speak up early, with these heavier weight languages. So C#, Java, not necessarily the scripting languages at first, right? So let's talk about the Java-like languages, right? So Java is really, really popular. It's heavily, heavily used in both research and industry. What's the characteristics about Java? What makes it better than, say, what came before it, C and C++?
Garbage collection,
memory management. Yes, automatic memory management. You can allocate away, and whatever happens, happens. Hopefully you have enough space to run in, right? What else? What? Threads? Threads? And sort of the high-level representation, easy use of threads instead of POSIX. How many have programmed in POSIX threads? Okay, good. Handful. That's great. How many folks have programmed in Java threads? Okay. So you know the difference, right? Vastly different. And again, really this evolution has been towards higher level languages, moving farther and farther away from the hardware, primarily for expressibility reasons. You want to be able to express yourself better, and you, if you have to do it with bits that are being twiddled in the operating or in the hardware, it's really hard to do that, right? It's you get bogged down in the details. So you need something more abstract. As you move farther and farther away from the hardware, however, you are able to, you know, design and implement lots of things really quickly. Programmer productivity, I would argue, has been one of the main drivers of a lot of these new languages. Okay? So what, is that the be-all, end-all? We just have very high-level languages? You know, we have really fast machines. So is that all we need? What do we have to do with these languages if they're very, very high level? Yeah, we have to get performance out of them. And you say, oh, well, you know, we have all the multiple cores and they're super fast and we're never going to notice. But, you know, what happens is like in that movie, if you build it, they will come. If you give people, if you look at Python codes and Java in the beginning and Ruby in the beginning, the codes are very simple. The applications were very simple. It was lightning fast because you weren't doing much. The scripting languages, when you just do the tiny little scripts, don't do a whole lot, right? And so they're lightning fast. You don't need a compiler and to get performance out of that because you execute it once and there's not a lot of looping and there's no matrix multiplication, right? So, but what's happened is, as these languages become more and more popular, you're going to use them for more and more stuff. And believe me, it's going to get complex really quick. It already has. You look at a piece of software sort of from the web services cloud computing systems, it is extremely complex. They're doing the thousands and thousands of lines of code in Ruby and Python. So now it's maybe time to start think, how are we going to get performance? Because as soon as you move away from the architecture, and we are in the sky, the compiler that has to translate that down to the bits that the hardware can execute has lots and lots of choices. And they don't know. It doesn't know your intent. It has all kinds of conflicting, foci, you know, objectives, right? It is really hard to do. Moreover, you know, things vary over time, right? Just because you have a program, you can look at it, we can optimize it. You can spend 5 weeks optimizing, sitting there hand optimizing a program, but you're doing it ahead of time. Until you know how it's going to execute, you really don't know the whole story, right? So things get complex pretty quick. And so that's why there's research problems here still. That's why it's important to think about the languages that are used in industry, even if they didn't come from academia, right? They can come from academia. We could design and build an entire new language. We could also look at the ones that are out there and figure out how to advance them, how to make them better, right? Okay. So I sort of break them up into two pieces. So I sort of mentioned this already. And to those that are sort of type safe, memory safe, statically typed, C sharp, Java, a lot of the .NET languages. And then the interpreted, dynamically typed scripting languages. Who knows what the difference between interpretation and compilation? Interpretation and compilation? Differences? Couple people? Good. Okay, good. I'm going to talk about it. First of all, I want to just make sure we know what the difference between statically typed and dynamically typed is. Heavily overloaded, heavily ambiguous terms, kind of hard to define. I would challenge you to sit there and think about, could you define them if I forced you to in front of everybody? It's tough. I'll tell you an easy way. With statically typed languages. Now there's lots of different terms here. All I'm talking about is statically typed languages. With statically typed languages, what you really want is to be able to check, to be able to have types assigned to everything, all operands that you're going to use for your operations in your language. Okay, so in order to do that statically, you got to look at the variables. You got to say, whatever this variable holds, I'm going to assume it holds a type, a certain type, or a type that's compatible with this type. And then I can see where that variable is being used, and if it's used in operations that for which it's valid, then I'm good. Okay? Now, think about that. By using types at the variable level, where you assign a type to a variable, then everything that the variable holds, you don't care what it is, right? Over time, as long as that variable holds a value that's compatible, then you have covered the entire execution of the program. All right, so another point I want to make here is that a lot of people confuse dynamic typing with the whether you have to declare the types or not. So a big argument on the web with these dynamic languages, Python and Ruby and JavaScript, is that you don't have to type the declaration of the types. You don't have to give types to your variables, right? Okay, but you could still have static typing, right? And you won't have to type in, you don't have to declare the types yourself, okay? The types are done implicitly. The system figures it out by how you use it. So Java and C# force you to put in those types, right? Force you. Okay, other languages, Scala, C#, the next generation, and ML are statically typed languages for which you don't have to type in the types. Okay, the system infers what those types are. If it can't figure it out, it'll give you a warning or an error, right? And you have to give it some more hints or some more information. It's ambiguous. All right, but all this says is that you can check statically ahead of time before the program executes that every single variable is used according to its type. All the operations that are in the type system are allowed to be performed on certain types, right? For the types that don't make sense for that operation, then those would have to be things that you'd catch when you would do type checking. From the dynamic side of things, Python, Ruby, JavaScript, these are dynamically typed, and really what happens is you just have a variable that has a name. It doesn't have a type, right? What is typed is the object. Same as for a static, but the variable has a type. Right, the variable is just a reference to these objects. These objects have types. And then at runtime, you can check for every operation whether the objects that are the operands are the right type. But you got to check at runtime. Okay, so I think that's a way to distinguish the two types of languages. I just talk about what a type system is. I'm just repeating myself. Yeah, of course.
What is the real advantage of those dynamic type languages?
The argument for these dynamically typed languages is the flexibility. You can do a lot of different things at runtime. If you force yourself to do things statically, I guess this is a better way to explain it, then you're going to make conservative assumptions. Because you assume that anything this guy holds is, so you're making your decisions based on the variable. But the variable could hold lots of things. But you're making your decisions based on the variable. Here, you could find a path that, you know, where your checking will fail, where you will not be able to proceed because you're being too conservative. Over here, the checking is only done on what you're executing, for one. And this allows you to, you know, actually check at runtime if this would actually work. So it's just, I think that's one of the arguments.
Can you give a more concrete example? Because I think this kind of static type languages are more readable.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Yes. There is a huge question. You'd be on one side of the fence. And there would be a whole other community on the other side of the fence who are, you know, the young gun programmers that just want, you know, they don't want to type in anything. They want to have a really high level, you know, fast prototyping language and then just have things happen at runtime to be checked. So I agree with you. I think that even though this is more conservative and you do things ahead of time, there's lots of downsides to here because you fail at runtime, which is bad. Can't do that on the Mars rover. You have to check every time. You've already checked it once. You go through that path again. You're checking it again, right? So anybody else want to argue on the side of dynamic typing? Yeah, I think the argument is flexibility. Yeah.
Well, just one concrete example of dealing with this asshole is
okay.
Heterogeneous lists are easy to do in dynamic typing. You know,
yes.
You have a list of things, and you don't necessarily want to constrain them to the
target.
Great.
That's a great example. So I guess it would be composite types. So types made up of a lot of different types. And again, all you care about is whether you use an element of that list with the right operation. And so you could then have these data structures that are heterogeneous. Great, great, great example. Thank you. Okay. So let's see. So Some of the other characteristics are that are similar across all these languages, dynamic and statically typed, interpreted and compiled. We have to worry about, again, you guys brought this up already. There's some domains for which the language is specific. This is a good opportunity for researchers. This is a good opportunity for engineers. Because if a language is used in a very well-defined way and almost constrains the user, right? I'm moving towards the side of the argument that says, I think our languages should do less. I think they should let us do less. I think they should be less flexible. Because then we communicate unambiguously what we want the hardware to do for us. Right? You don't have to be low level to do that. You can still express your algorithms at a high level. But you want to be able to do it without a lot of choices. If you're given thousands of choices to do the same thing, that's great for you, flexibility. One, you have to decide. You might get it wrong. It takes you some time to think about. If I only give you three choices, all right, you still have choice, but it's constrained, so you'll be faster to pick one. It greatly simplifies the runtime. It greatly simplifies the analysis and the optimization that you're going to do. You're much more likely. You're much more likely, if you use Ruby on Rails, to stay within that Rails framework. I challenge you to try anything outside of that Rails framework. Anything funky. It will take you forever because the language is not meant to go outside a very specific domain. But that's great for the runtime and for the compiler or the interpreter. Because I know your intent. If you're given 10,000 ways of doing things and they all overlap, I have no idea what your intent is, right? Okay, so we want to kind of capture that. Functional languages, some of you mentioned them when we gave our list. They have really emerged. They've come back full circle. We've had them all in the 80s. We had all the stuff that we know about today. MapReduce, that's been around for 25 years, and now it's all back, right? We always reinvent the wheel. Make sure you know your history. Make sure you know in your area what the history is. Do not get caught out, because you'll go and interview somewhere and there'll be an old guy in the back of the room and he had done the exact same thing 25 years ago. I've seen it many times, right? Be careful. Know your history. Go back. It will always be different. We have new hardware. We have new software. Even if you're doing the exact same thing, it'll be different because you're in a new, because you're in a new context. But you have to give credit. You have to know what happened before you. All right, functional languages happened before us. But we've reinvented them all, and they're actually quite nice, actually. There's quite a few really interesting ones. I list a few of them up there. I just went through an exercise last year learning Erlang. It's a highly concurrent, event-driven language. It's from Ericsson. There's lots and lots of different ones. Like QL is like all the query languages. That's more logical, but they're still functional. And then, of course, JVM languages. These are languages that are new, but they run on top of the JVM. These are interesting because, one, you have open source JVMs, so now you can investigate whether the use of these types of languages is really similar to the behavior of Java programs or not. Right? You're still using the same intermediate representation, and it's going to, you know, the Java VM. Is the behavior different or not? Can you exploit the fact that you're in a functional domain like Scala or not? Or a scripting language like Jython or JRuby or not? So there's lots of interesting opportunities here if you're interested in these kind of languages. Clojure is also very interesting, functional language. I think one of my students is really interested in figuring out its behavior and how it can be used, say, for interesting application domains like streaming. Anyway, so there you go. So we have lots of different languages. Some of them are have domains or a large portion of the language sticks within a domain. And so you can focus on a small, well-defined subset of the language and make some progress. If you know that your users are going to use most of that subset, you'll win. There's incremental loading and execution. That's different from static programs. A lot of times if you're going to statically build something like a C++ or a C program, you got to have it all. You got to have the entire program. You know, the libraries have to be there, and you build it all at once. Right? Here in modern languages, the program comes in pieces. Right? Java class files come one at a time over the net. Python programs file at a time. If you can even generate code on the fly, right? You can add methods. You can add classes to these scripting languages, right? That means you don't know. You have no idea. You can't know what the program is going to look like down the road, right? So you can't look at the whole program and say, oh, you know, these two guys call each other all the time, so I'm going to somehow inline those to make those run faster. Okay, you can't know. And so the first time you see something, that your view of the world may be one thing. But later on, when it executes longer, your view of the world might have completely changed. You need to be able to adapt. You need to be able to change your decisions. All right. Vast library support. I'd argue this is one of the reasons why the popularity of these modern languages have really taken off. Everything's done in the libraries. You don't have to program hardly anything these days. It's great. You know, I think if, you know, we had done something more along the lines of this for C++ and made it a little bit easier, so cut off, you know, 3/4 of the language, we might have been able to have some higher popularity values for that language. Object-oriented. We really stuck with object-oriented, primarily because it gives us, you know, more of an intuitive view of, you know, how data is manipulated with its code. It gives us an ability to design more sort of in the same way we view the world. And so it's, again, intuitive and easy for us to express algorithms and programs and data manipulation in an object-oriented fashion. So that's around. I think that'll be around to stay. It's hard to optimize, by the way, so we'll talk about how to make that run faster. High level, easy to use. I'd argue that, you know, there are people, there's tons of people out there who don't have computer science degrees, who are not computer scientists, but still need to communicate with the computer, need to get the computer to do its work, his or her work, right? So these languages have to be amenable to these folks, right? A random person needs to be able to learn one of these languages really quickly and do something with them. Right? And this varies from just, you know, your average Joe who is just interested in building something for a computer to scientists. Scientists have to focus on the science, right? They need to be able to communicate what they need to get done very simply, very easily, right? This is key. This is really different than what was the way in the past. In the past, it's been about all about experts. We are experts. We all can come up with our own language that we love, and then we will focus on it, and no one else will be able to have access to it. All right, no longer the day. The day is, and even for you, you know, having low-level control, I mean, it's cool and everything. But believe me, I have expert coders on my team. And they are diehard C fans, and they will program something, and I'll give them challenges all the time. I'll make them program in C, and I'll make them do it in Python. Or I'll make them do it in C, and I'll make them do it in Ruby or JavaScript. And it is amazing how many fewer bugs, number one. Now, they're lightning fast at C, so they aren't that much faster with Python, but just because they don't know it as well. But man, my number of bugs, you know, I still haven't convinced them, but it's there. Garbage collected, you guys mentioned this. Portable is interesting. Write once, run anywhere. Java coined it. It's still around. It will be around forever, I think. We have lots of different systems. We have lots of things that we want to run apps on. Right? And they are all different, especially at this level. But even at this level, right? The system is extremely different. So we want to write things once and run them. Okay, that means that we have to have the runtimes, the things that do the translation on every system. That's better than all of us having all of our programs ported to every system. Right? And they have to be widely available. Again, it can't be small, closed door, back room type group anymore. You know, it really has to be available to the whole world. You've got to expose yourself. You've got to put it out there. I'd argue it has to be open source. I say you're not going to improve and really make our system robust until you get a user community. And this is something we should talk about as graduate students and researchers, right? Sharing with your community is no longer just results. It's actually with tools and open source infrastructures that others can use and compare your techniques against theirs, right? And really forward science. All right, so all this necessitates, this is great. Sure, we need all this. All right, now we got to build it. We got to build a runtime that it gives us all of this, right? A runtime that's going to take a program in one of these languages and make all this happen. And it happens all at runtime. So So normally, if you have a C program, you run it. It's, you know, all you're doing is running the program. Here, you're doing all this other stuff. You're you know, making sure the libraries are in there. You're allowing the program to load incrementally. You're translating. It's portable, so you're translating it on the fly. You're garbage collecting. You're doing a lot more than what you would do if you had just a binary that's already compiled, right? So you're interrupting your users. And again, I'd argue performance matters. Maybe it doesn't matter for your little shell scripts that you run on your Unix box or your Linux box, but it does matter, and it will matter more and more as we move forward because our systems are getting more and more complex. Okay, questions? All right, so I thought I'd just kind of go through a few of the basics, and a lot of this you'll know, and some of it you might not, but just bear with me. I just want to kind of show you the similarities. What's really happening in these modern high-level languages are that you program in source, right? You write out the source code. And in most of these languages, that source code is converted to an intermediate form. It's bytecode, right? It's binary. It's some representation of your program. Okay, we call it bytecode. Just as Java, for example, Java, and so there's lots of compilers in the system now, right? So you've got to differentiate. When someone's talking about building a compiler or using a compiler, you've got to ask which one, because there's lots. First one is called a source compiler, and I do this just to keep my head straight about which is which. Source compiler, this means you're going to take source, and you're going to produce some intermediate form, some bytecode, right? Class files. Now, we could take these class files, or we could take this source, we could take it, pump it into a static compiler, GCC will handle both. For Java, bytecode and source, and compiles it all together, produces an executable or a dynamically linkable, dynamically loadable app. That's fine. You gotta have all the code there though, no dynamic loading. You know, gotta have, you know, this ability to, you know, either integrate garbage collection or build a garbage collection component as a library into this, right? This is not what I focus on. I'm not as interested in this because it really does constrain the dynamism, the flexibility you have. But this is totally an option, right? This is just a source file. It's just a little bit more compact, right? Representation. We'll talk about what that looks like. What normally happens, however, is you have this representation and then you pass that to a runtime. And then the runtime translates it. So the runtime's usually on a remote box. So let's say you program on your desk side and you put it up on the web. And then when I download it, I download it to my machine, that's when my runtime executes and converts that bytecode to native code of my machine and executes it. Does a whole bunch of other stuff. Gives me garbage collection, gives me threading and synchronization, loads programs on the parts of the program on demand. It's not all shipped at once. That would be stupid, because are you going to use the whole program? You know, over here, when we were doing all of our static stuff, you're compiling everything. Who says you're ever going to touch everything? I'd argue that it's a really small percentage. Those codes, the real systems that I've looked at, a really small percentage of the overall code that's used by any one individual, any one set of inputs, right? So by transmitting this incrementally, you only transmit what you're going to execute. You're triggering it. You're calling it over because you're going to use it. Yeah.
But what about dynamic libraries?
They are linked at runtime.
Yep.
You can upgrade them. So.
Yes. A lot of times, this is that the libraries are stored on your.
And I'm going to have a set of standard libraries on the remote machine. And so the runtime is responsible for linking them in. They're either linked into the runtime itself, and then the runtime just makes calls to them when it sees the code, hooks up the symbols to the call.
Yeah. What I was trying to
say is that even the static languages use dynamic loading of the code.
Yes. And that's
so you can load it in different places, right? Yeah. So you have that. First of all, you still have to compile everything together. You have to have the whole program when you have it. Secondly, again, they're usually libraries. You don't usually make your own code libraries. I mean, if you have an app that's using the libraries, what really is happening here is the granularity is on the class file, is on these files. So it's just a finer grain of loading. I'd say that's probably what the best way to look at it is. It's a good question, though. Other questions on this? Okay, so again, translator, in this case a Java virtual machine, translates bytecode to native code, right? This is exactly the same for C#, exactly. All I did was change the names. I use Mono, because I'm a Linux person, not a Windows person. This is Mono's source compiler. Same thing. The bytecode's a little different, but it's still bytecode. Right? It's still an intermediate form. Notice that intermediate form also is architecture independent. It does not run on any machine. There's one little caveat, which I'll mention in a second. But it doesn't run on anything. It's a virtual machine ISA, a virtual machine instruction set architecture. So it doesn't run anywhere. But it's the same. Java has it. C-sharp has it. C-sharp or the .NET languages compile to MSIL. It's also called CIL, or it used to be. That's just another name for their bytecode. And then it has a common language runtime, Java Virtual Machine, that does exactly the same stuff in their own proprietary way. Python, same thing. Python takes source. You could let's just do it this way. Take source. If you're packaging it up, you could call PyC and create these PyC files. Just a bytecode file, architecture independent, binary file. I'll talk about what the formats look like in a second. And then the Python runtime takes those, converts it to native code, and executes. Now, a lot of times if you run Python, you probably haven't, if you're new to it, haven't generated this step yourself. So what happens is the runtime can just take the Python files, but what it does internally is just this. Gets the bytecode and then executes it. So you can either hand the runtime the bytecode and it'll execute it, or you can hand the runtime the source file, the source code, and it'll compile it to bytecode, source compile it to bytecode, and then execute it. Okay? Same thing. Of all the languages that are out there today, they all go to some sort of bytecode format. Ruby is the exception. Now, there's some efforts that are pushing Ruby into the bytecode realm, JRuby for one, that runs over a JVM, because it makes sense, because JVM requires bytecode. But the de facto standard, which is called MRI, Matz's Ruby interpreter, this is the creator of Ruby, his interpreter, there is no specification for the language, by the way, of Ruby. There is for these other languages. And so the only way you know the semantics of the language is to use this interpreter as a reference. And so this reference interpreter, this is really this is the default interpreter that you get when you download a Ruby interpreter, in most cases. And what it does is, instead of generating bytecode, it just takes the statements, the source, and makes an abstract syntax tree and executes the tree, the operations on the tree. That's the only one. So that's a little bit different. Okay, so let's talk about this bytecode for all these languages that have it. All right, it's a stack-based machine. It's a virtual machine, right? So it's a instruction set architecture, just like for the x86 or the PowerPC or whatever. But instead, it's going to an architecture that doesn't exist, a virtual architecture. Right? So that's why it's called virtual machine instruction set architecture. The virtual machine itself is a stack architecture. Right? So abstractly, you have a stack where all your operands are. Now, this is a stack that's used for the operands of each individual operation at the statement level. Okay, don't confuse this with the runtime stack. It's still a FIFO, but the runtime stack is our ability to execute functions, right, or methods, and have the local scope to the functions. This is for each individual instruction, an operand stack, right? So it was used in hardware. There actually is real hardware out there for this type of architecture. It was used in the old HP calculators. You also see it in Java Card. Java Card is an implementation of the bytecode hardware, of the bytecode ISA, right? Its operand stack is just a stack. It's a registers. So you push onto these registers and you pop when you get things off. When you exceed, when you push too many things on, it goes out to memory, very fast memory. That's how Java Card works. Okay, but abstractly, what do you have? You have a bunch of instructions that push and pop. Doesn't matter if that's hardware or a piece of memory that you're pushing and popping to, your operands are just stored there. Okay? What are the other instruction set architectures? If it's not stack-based, what are the instruction set architectures that exist? What is a PowerPC, or what is a x86 instruction set architecture? Is it stack-based? Start there. Register-based. Two types of register-based instruction set architectures. What are they? RISC, okay, and CISC, okay, and what are the key differences there? What's the difference between RISC and CISC? Fundamentally, where you get your operands. Memory or registers for which one?
Risk is from registers.
Risk is only from registers. So you get all your operands and from memory and put them into registers, and then you do your operations. CISC, you can do anything you want. Some of your operands are in memory, some of them are in registers. You can put them into registers, do whatever you want. You get all the freedom. Good. So I call them register memory. This means that an operand, this is, what are the operands doing? Where are your operands? That's the question. On a stack-based machine, they're on the stack. On a register memory machine, they're either in registers or memory. And that's going to be CISC. And on a register-register machine, both your operands, like two operands, like you think about an add, right? So of an add, your operands could be in registers or memory. For an add on a RISC processor, they both have to be in registers. This is also called a load store machine because you got to load everything and store everything to and from registers. Okay, so why use a stack-based machine if everything we know and love are register machines? I'm going to register machines. And really, you know, everything's a register machine today. So why would I? So I want portability. So portability says, well, you want to make it generic, right? But let's go one step further. What if all of our machines today that our code's going to run on are register machines? We got to get from a stack-based machine to a register machine. One of the most hideous operations there is to do in terms of performance. Hideous, really hard, nasty, yuck. So why would I make a stack-based machine for this bytecode? All these languages are doing it. Why?
To avoid the register allocation once and for all.
What if I give you infinite registers? What if I just said, just make infinite registers? No register allocation.
Well, then you would still be putting that off.
But that's still a research question. Whether it would be faster to go from stack to x86 or an infinite register representation to a x86. But something more. Think about what the representation looks like. What else? What is a stack-based? Yeah.
Code size, exactly.
Stack can be, they're all variable length instructions, mostly, let's see. RISC is usually fixed length instructions. Stack's always variable length instructions. So all these bytecode representations are variable length. This is nice. Why is variable length instructions nice? Are nice? There's a lot of reasons why they're not. What's a positive? Variable length instructions, start there. Hardware now. Hardware variable length instructions. Why are they good?
No wasted space.
Why are they bad? They're just irregular. Anything irregular is going to kill you in terms of making it run fast, right? So what you got to do is you have to just read in a little bit, and you say, oh, is this how long is this instruction? And then you know how much to read, and then you don't know where the next instruction starts. If they're all for 32 bits, that's easy. It's so much easier, right? So that's the argument between CISC and RISC. One of the arguments. But anyway, back to what we're talking about. Variable length instructions are really good for compactness, so that you are really only using the space you need. And they're compact because you can encode some information with the instruction itself, but all your operands, instead of specifying what register it's in, because here I have to show you this. Here's load store, so register, and register memory, okay? Here, your operands have to be encoded in the instruction. You need more bits to encode the operands in your instruction. Back here for stack, your operands are where? On the operand stack. They're implicit. You don't have to encode them anywhere. The opcode knows. The opcode tells the system where the operands are. You may have some information here about an operand, but not all. You won't ever have all the operands here. Most of your operands are going to be on the stack. So what this gives you is a very compact representation. Very compact. It's also very simple. So those two arguments, and because we don't know the answer, if we wanted to make a register-based instruction set, people have tried. There's still room for research there. I think it needs to be pursued. But we don't know what you can't. Nothing's ever really infinite. What does that mean? Is it really that much faster than stack? You know, if you introduce an intermediate form that is register-based, you lose all this compactness. So now I'm shipping a ton more. For what? Am I going to amortize that cost? It's a very interesting question. Okay, we good? We understand why we're using stack-based machines for our intermediate representation? Yeah.
One other argument for stack-based is when you're, if you're interfacing with the system, the arguments that you pass for that external function call are nicely arrayed in the stack, whereas if you have to peel them out of a subset of the registers.
I think you're exactly right that it argues for portability. If you know you're always going to the same compiler or the same target architecture, then it makes sense to customize your representation. But because we want to go to a lot, the many different ones all have different, they expect different things. So it's much easier to have something like this where you could pull out your operands or your parameters as you go across languages. So I think that's a good argument too. Okay? Do we understand this? Okay. The downside is going to be, how are we going to get from this to this? All right? Compiler's got to do it. It's really hard. Here's some information about modern bytecode systems. JVM, the opcodes themselves are typed. So if this is because it's a type-safe language, like C# is, so it'll also have typed operations. Again, if you want to do an add, it's an iAdd if it's on integers. It's an fadd on float if it's a, I think that's pretty much it. Let's say you're moving a value to the top of the stack. You're going to move it according to its type. You're going to move it with an I for integers, F for float, A for references, object references. So it's all typed. And this is really nice because you take your source and you produce this bytecode, and then I can still verify that you're ensuring type safety, right? So I have to have type information. Right, but that's a choice, right? By encoding that in your bytecode, you use more bits in your opcodes, right? You use more information. MSIL, pretty much exactly the same as JVM, only a few more things. Okay, all stack-based. There's how many? 253 are used for bytecode. I have no idea about MSIL. I couldn't find it. It's just a mess out there. But they're 2 bytes in length, like potentially 64K. I don't think they're using anything more than, I had a student do a project once just to do a verifier for MSIL for programs, and I think it was on the order of 300 opcodes that he was focused on and are commonly used. Python, 113 opcodes, 42 with arguments, 71 without. I just put that in there because that's something we've been focused on recently. I'll tell you about that in a second. Why that is. And this means arguments in addition to the stack. Okay? You know, like when you say push A, you're going to memory, the local variable location for A, and getting that value out of memory and putting it on the top of the stack. And so there's an argument with that instruction. So that opcode will have an argument, and others like add won't. Add has no arguments. It knows to take the two things off the top of the stack, pull them off, add them up, push the result back on. Okay? Yeah.
So why would we use a bytecode and compile to a certain circuit architecture rather than a source to source compiler?
That is a great
question. Why? Can someone else answer that? Yeah.
Right, I'd argue the compilers out there are pretty darn good nowadays. So you cannot bytecode, you're handing out source. It's a good point, but there's something very different between source and bytecode.
Static semantics.
Static semantics, yeah. So you're doing a lot of that
for that ahead of time, but something bigger or smaller. Size. It's all about the size of the files you're transmitting. We're thinking about storage, and we're thinking about transferring over the network, and so it's really about compactness. With your source, you have documentation, you have spaces to make it all pretty so that we can read it and enjoy it. If you don't. Yeah, okay, great. So that's the same kind of thing. It's just trying to do that automatically for you. And it's trying to remove that step from you. It's trying to automate that step. It's really about compactness. And if you think about it, parsing, sort of our source representation takes effort. Parsing something like a bytecode is so much simpler. because there's many fewer and possible instructions. And so it's both compactness and efficiency when you get to the target. Again, we're doing so much at runtime already. We want to at least prep the system so we do a little bit less. So if you code really compactly and you zip it, you still got to unzip it when you get there. But you do, so you did the work. That's all this is trying to do. It's trying to make it smaller and it's trying to make it really easy to access on the far end.
There's another reason why I would think that would be, you know, kind of not a bad idea.
Okay.
If a machine from the operating system perspective, the hypervisor kind of idea,
yep.
is a neat idea to avoid the performance bottleneck that translating from bytecode to machine code as a problem to. So, if I could have a nice representation and something that can be compiled for performance reasons or shipped along with your compact bytecode, but run very efficiently in a virtual machine hypervisor way.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea.
I mean, that's right way to be thinking. And the virtualization layer, however, gets a lot of its performance when its architecture, ISA, is the same as the one in the hypervisor. So if it has to do translation, so what I thought you were getting at, which I think is a good idea, is have the representation be something that the hypervisor can easily translate to, lower level, right? Right now, it tries to avoid any translation at all to get the performance. But I think there's something there. I think that might be worth pursuing to think about, since I know everything pretty much today is virtualized, can I exploit that to get less overhead when I have to do the translation when I get there? Right? Good point. Okay, anything else here? Let's see. Okay, so now we need the translator. A couple ways to do translation. First thing we can do is just interpret. Interpret means take line by line each statement in your program. Either it can be source or it can be bytecode. We're talking about bytecode here pretty much. And you decode it, figure out what the opcode is, figure out where the operands are, and do the operation. It's really nice because you and I could write it in an afternoon. If I gave you the bytecode specification for any of those languages that I just showed you, Python, Java, or MSIL, or JVM, MSIL, or Python, bytecode, we could write an interpreter for it. Really, we could, in C, or Java, or some other language. Because all you're doing is you're saying, okay, you can write a decoder, you can just parse the statement or the bytecode, figure out what operand is, and you know if it's an add, then you need to grab the two operands off the top of the stack, you need to add them, and you need to put the operand back. We could just implement an operand stack. We could just allocate a piece of memory and push and pop from it. Right? So what you're doing is you're not writing any assembly, right? Low-level native code. You're just writing to a high-level language. You're just parsing, decoding, and actually implementing the functionality, emulating the functionality of that operation. Right? So it's really nice. You then compile it. Say you do it in C. Most people do it in C. You then compile it with GCC, and now you have an interpreter that'll run for your high-level language or your high-level bytecode. Okay, this is really nice for fast prototyping. Interpreter has been used forever, since the dawn of time, since languages were first defined, to be able to test out what are the semantics, the dynamic semantics of a language. What are the features that I want in my language? What is the statement? What statements do I need? What statements don't I need? Right. So it's really nice. So if you take a language and you want to add something to it, I totally recommend you get an interpreter and do it first, even if it's performance-oriented. Get an interpreter, make sure you understand how the functionality is working, and how your functionality is well-defined, and then you can use a compiler or write a compiler or write code in a compiler to handle your new features. This is a much faster way of doing it. So the implementation of the interpreter then is a decode and dispatch loop. So again, line by line, I seriously mean line by line. So if you have a series of instructions, 1 through 4, and they're in a loop, every time you go around that loop and you execute it again, you're going to decode and dispatch. You're going to decode, figure out what the opcode is, what are the operands, do the operation. Again and again and again. right? Line by line. So no optimization usually. Maybe there's some just very local, intelligence, but really there's not. This is the main loop for the Python interpreter in CPython. Okay, it's all interpreters look like this. It's a big loop, infinite loop, and it's a big switch statement in the middle. First thing we do here is we grab the opcode, some sort of iterator, and this is all in C. Next up just grabs the next iterator. You're just walking through the opcode in the bytecode stream that's being executed. We check if there's arguments. Remember, I said there's a 42 with arguments, and then the rest not or something like that. I forget which what I said. 42 with arguments, 71 without. So we do that check, and if it does have arguments, we grab them. And then we switch on the opcode, find the right bytecode. All the bytecodes are listed here. And we in this, you can either make a call to a function that handles it, or you can inline here the actual functionality that you want to emulate for this instruction. All right? And then when you're done, you break out of the switch statement, you go back around, get the next opcode. Okay, so you can see really local. All you see is a statement that is at a time. Very little state going from one instruction to another. That's why you'll see lots of redundancy. It's why there's a lot of overhead here. There's no intelligence. Think about an ad. You know, you're gonna you know that there's gonna be a push ad and probably a pop of some sort. So you're gonna put the values on. You're gonna do an ad and then you're gonna pop. And usually they're gonna be right next to each other. Because when you do an ad, it's usually that when you compile to bytecode, it's going to set it up that way. Push, push, add, pop. Right? All right, so but you have no notion of that. All you see is a push. You don't know if a push came before me or a push came after me or an add comes after me. Who knows? You don't have any understanding of that. Okay? So this is really fast. It's easy to write. You get it up and running in no time, in one afternoon. For these languages, but the disadvantage is that they're very slow. This process could be 100 times slower for a decent sized application than a compiled language, right? So let's just talk about the interpreter for a second. So we sort of want the interpreter. Think about the benefits of the interpreter, and again, why interpreters are so important today. Whereas even a few years ago, everyone was like, oh no, everything will be JITted soon. Everything will be compiled. JITted is just compiled soon. But no, these languages really have their interpreters, and interpreters are what's used in everyone's system. And the reason is, they're very easy to write. There's no porting of the interpreter. Okay, not only do we have write once, run anywhere for your apps, now you have write once, run anywhere for your interpreter, because all it is a bunch of C code. All you do is bring it over, compile it, and hopefully it'll work. Right? Compilers, you're writing assembly for a particular architecture. You got to do that for every single architecture you want to run on. Right? And so there's an advantage here. However, it's really slow. So we've got to find ways of making this faster so that we can answer the question, which is an open question. Is it interpretation? Is it compilation? Is it some combination of the two? We don't know the answer, and the answer varies by language and by the application you're running. I would argue that there is no need for a compiler if you have really small scripts. So Bash and C Shell and Unix should never be JITted, right? They are lightning fast. They are really short. If you start to run on the orders of thousands of lines, however, it might be worth thinking about. Okay. So let's just talk about, what would happen if we could just speed this up? This seems really kind of dumb, right? There's a lot of, you know, silly stuff here we could get rid of. There's been a lot of work in interpretation, just for optimizing interpretation. Recent work, publishable work, very good work, and not mine. Just to be clear, I do present other people's stuff here, and I'll claim what's mine when I get to it. But I mean, I'm studying this. It's really interesting to me. If you look at what really damages performance today on our modern architectures, it's definitely memory accesses, caching and stuff. But it's also branches. Let's take a look and see how many branches we got here. Well, we got a big old infinite loop. Doesn't bode very well for trying to limit our branches, right? Big old ugly thing. It goes around every single instruction. All right, that's a lot of branches. It's not predictable. The outer branch will be predictable, and then the jump back will be pretty predictable. So we might be able to just reduce some of that overhead. here, this, we're only doing for, what, 42 instructions and 71, this is a bad, this is not taken. So for 42, this is taken. For 71, it's not taken. Okay, that's not predictable. This is your stream of instructions coming in. Can you predict which one's going to be and one with arguments and which one's not? No, we need to get rid of that. This hasn't actually been done. We just did this recently to see if it would improve performance, and it really does. Take this out and put it in the ones that have arguments. That simple, right? But you got to think this way now. You got to think. You got to eke out every single inefficiency. You got to get it out because you can't afford it here. Because you want the portability and the benefits of interpretation, but you cannot tolerate the 100x slowdown. No one will use it for large systems. Big ol' switch case. Completely unpredictable. Where are you going to switch? Depends on the opcode. Opcode is in the stream. It's terrible. There's going to be a small subset of opcodes, 10, 15, some cases 20, but mainly around 10 or 15% of your opcodes are heavily used. Everything else are rare. Just like the model with all our software, that only a small portion of what you're given is actually used heavily by 90% of your code or 80%, right? All right, so what we could do is we could put the guys that are more likely to execute up front and make it, you can kind of set up your branching here so that you, all the stuff that are commonly used are up top or predictable. This is kind of hand wavy, but this is possible. You can set it up so that you branch accordingly. And what you want to do is you want to bias your branches. You want to make sure that if you have a branch in your code for something like this, that it's always taken most of the time, as much as possible, and not taken for a little bit of time, right? Or the opposite. That you just got to give the branch predictor and the hardware a chance. The other problem is that it turns out, if you look at the whole interpreter or any interpreter, there's just tons of different branches. Right? We're running into capacity problems, right? You can only store, so a branch predictor is just going to store addresses and say whether it's taken or not. It's an oversimplification, but that's a good abstract view. However, it's a table. When you run out of space, you're going to reuse that space. It's like a hash, so you're going to put a bunch of stuff there and they're going to overwrite each other, and then you got to check, is this the address the same as this address, right? You only have a limited number of slots. So if you have a ton of branches, even if they're all biased, you're going to be hurt. Right? And this turns out to be a huge killer for Python especially, but and Java, not as much. Java's more predictable, and you can set it up in a pretty intelligent way. But Python, because if you know Python, the way Python works is it looks up everything by name. If you want to execute a method or you want to access a variable, you do it by name in a big old hash table. Okay, that is a ton of branches. Each one is a conditional check, and there's all kinds of checks. Okay, so that's Python language. This is the interpreter. This has a bunch of branches. If the language itself didn't have a bunch of branches, then this might work. You know, you just kind of be a little bit intelligent. So the patchwork on Java, which doesn't have a ton of branches, not as many as Python, shows that by just ordering this and getting rid of this out of the loop, and I'll tell you how to do that, does pretty well. But now you introduce Python. Python introduces, tremendous numbers of branches. And then there's all these branches. So everybody gets kicked out. We have capacity problems. Everything's conflicting. And none of the branch predictor is just not working. And so a lot of these optimizations don't work as well. These are the three optimizations that are used in interpretation that are in the literature, recent literature, that actually are very effective for Java interpretation. We've tried them for Python. They don't work as well because of this branch problem. Primarily because if we could get rid of some of these branches in the language, then we'd give the branch predictor a better chance. All right, so you can, instead of decoding every time, just remember what you decoded. So let's say you have instruction number 27, and you decode it, and it's in a loop. Every time you come around to 27, you decode it again. So why not just save it off? Instead of saving off, the ID for 27, maybe save off a reference to its decoding, or maybe encode its the operation itself in the instruction. I know that's hand wavy, but really what I'm saying is just save off what you've done and use it again the next time around. Okay, so I'm sorry, that's pre-decoding. You want to save off every time you decode. Direct threading, this means instead of using that big outer loop, right? What is the outer loop doing? You're going around to the outside, and then at the top, you're decoding. You're saying, hey, what's the opcode? Right? Instead of that, why don't you just, you know, go into the first instruction, and at the end of every instruction, just decode there and see where you're going next. So instead of having this loop where you go back out and see where am I going next, instead, you go to the first instruction, you perform the operation, you say, where am I going next? So the code, where am I going next, is in every single case entry. Are you with me? Every single case entry now, the add, the fast, the load fast, every no op, in every one, at the end, it goes ahead and decodes the instruction and says, where am I going next? And goes to the next one. It processes that. At the end of that, it says, where am I going next? Goes to the next one. You're threading the individual cases throughout the system instead of going all the way outside, going through the outer loop again. Saves us a few branches. You say, that doesn't sound like a big deal. It's a huge deal. Makes a huge difference. All those branches are now not in your branch predictor table, and they're not getting in your way, and you don't have to jump to them. Right? There is more code. You've always got to analyze your trade-offs. What have I done? I put, where am I going next, that code, into every single case. So it offsets things differently.
It's also not portable seeding.
Yes, because of the long jumps. Yes, yes. The jumps, yes. Good question. Good point. Yes, that's technical. You can get around that by having two sets, but yeah. Good. So yeah, but you've got to understand those trade-offs and what the limitations are. Portability is really key. And then the other thing is, think about add. Push, push, add, pop. Push, push, add, pop. Every time you see an add, it's usually push, push, add, pop. Why not put those together? Because a push, push, add, pop just says, I know where the operands are, just go get them directly. Add them. I know where they're going because the pop tells me. Put them back. So you have these subsequences of bytecodes that happen together all the time. Process them together. What you're doing really is introducing new cases. Case, instead of if it's a push, you just check, am I a push, push, add, pop? If so, go here. Right? And so there's these common sequencing you can do. And again, this is pretty much state of the art. It doesn't get much better than this. It's about as fast as you can go. It's still slower than jitting. It's on the order of, it could be anywhere from, a few percentage up to 5, 10 X, but it's not 100 X anymore. So that's the state of the art. It still needs work. Still a lot to do here. Why not just compile it? All that work, all that energy. I'm still 10 times slower, right? And the reason is portability. So I'll stop there since it's 20 after. I'll talk about compilation next time and then talk about some shared memory stuff. I will change my slides because I'm not getting through all the things I thought I could. And so I will update them on that webpage if you want to grab the new ones. Tomorrow we can do that when I'm here. Anyway, thanks for your time. I'll talk to you after if you like.